Venerable, if you're ready, I can share the screen for the Refuge and Bodhicitta prayer.
Good idea.
Okay. No, that's perfect. Absolutely perfect.
All right.
So those of us who want to, we just, I mean, it's, you know, we, as you know, the Lamas always say, state our motivation. I suppose we would say, state our purpose, or set our goal. So what's our purpose of being here together? Well, the first two lines of this prayer, as we can see, it's those of us who kind of already figure we're Buddhists, it's reminding us of our reliance on the Buddha and his Dharma and so on. But the second two lines, that's expressing this altruistic motivation, you know, that we're going to do this job of listening to this Dharma together, including me, I promise, so that we can become a Buddha to benefit sentient beings. I mean, that's a long-term goal, you know. But when we understand the meaning of motivation, we understand, like we mentioned briefly yesterday, actually, when we understand the meaning of stating the thought, which is becomes the basis of your action, that thought actually characterizes the action in that way, you know. That's really when we should talk about karma. I don't know whether it's, well, not meant to be tonight, but you never know, it might come. So we do this little prayer, those of us who'd like to state our purpose together. Sangye charam soke karam sa baru dagni kyabsu chi dagi chonien gi personam ki drola penche sangye drupa sho Sangye charam soke choknam la kyangcho baru dagni kyabsu chi dagi chonien gi personam ki drola penche sangye drupa sho Sangye charam soke choknam la kyangcho baru dagni kyabsu chi dagi chonien gi personam ki drola penche Sangye drupa sho. Okay. So I think our time tonight, something about our roommates, isn't it? But thought translation. But I mean, that's a kind of a bit advanced, I think. I'm not sure. It is advanced. And I think just one of the things that I think we find a bit surprising in our culture. And when we hear spiritual practice, we don't think of it as structured, of organized, as incremental, as gradual. You know, we don't think it like that. You know, we know very well if you study violin or mathematics, you start at the early stuff, you go to the middle stuff, and you go to the advanced stuff, and then you graduate. Well, as we know very well from the Tibetan packaging that we know called the Lam Rim, this gradual path, it just means it's a course, you know. And it's actually internalizing Buddha's teachings. I mean, that's really what being a Buddhist is, internalizing Buddha's approach to life and making it yours. And so naturally, you know, there's a beginning stage, a more advanced stage, and the most advanced stage. And I think it takes a while for us to realize that. I think one of the things that attracts a lot of people to Buddhism is because it's compassion. But as you compare, you know, if you take this Lam Rim, as we know, that's called the great scope, or if you look at the two wings of the bird, it's the compassion wing. Well, you know, I like to think of it as junior school, high school, university, and indeed, you know, Tantra, that's postgraduate. We get those concepts, and they really speak to us, you know. Well, compassion actually is advanced. Compassion is, and we discussed this quite a lot, I'm sure we discussed it yesterday. We did. Now, unless we work on our own selves first, which is junior school and high school, we are just not capable of helping others. And that's hard to hear, because we don't quite know what that means, you know. Because I think when we think of compassion, we tend to think, oh, well, I've got some compassion. That's it. I'm compassionate. And this is the thing. We never think of it as something that we can grow to an unbelievable level, you know. We don't think of it as a growth somehow, of developing. We don't think of it as, you know, gradually becoming more and better and better and better at things. Kind of, we think of it as a bit more static. I'm a nice person. I do my practice every day, you know. But it's gradual. It's growth, you know. And the wisdom wing, which is the work we do on ourselves, it is an impossibility to be able to have proper compassion without having done that first. And the more we see the logic of this, the more we will really understand. You know? So talking about thought transformation, I mean, that's the most advanced level of the compassion wing. Compassion wing is advanced, and that's the most advanced level of the compassion wing. I mean, you know, somehow when we start to talk about it, The approach is really, it's quite intense. I mean, already Buddha's teachings are pretty intense. Then we were talking about yesterday, which is the basic Buddha's teachings. The basic Buddha's teaching, the essence of Buddha's teachings is that we are suffering because of what's in our mind. I mean, that is actually outrageous. That is really shocking. And especially when we see such terrible suffering around the world, you know, people being brutalized and terrorized and raped and murdered in war zones. And then you hear Buddha says, excuse me, you suffer because of your mind? What are you talking about? That already is outrageous. But that's what you do that in the wisdom wing. Then they get to the point where you're in the compassion wing, where you actually, a bodhisattva, the level of bodhisattva practice is to greet the problems with a happy mind. I mean, that's what's demented for us, you know. I mean, all I know is when I start to talk about these higher levels of bodhicitta, for me, it's like, it freaks me out. It's too heavy. It's too high, you know. I remember Lama Zopa when I saw him last year for something about one of his books, and he said, do you ever talk about bodhicitta? And I kind of blurted out. No, he says, too much. It's too heavy. I can't cope, you know. I mean, often one of the commonest things that attracts the West to Buddhism is because it's about compassion. But when we really begin to understand the level of compassion the Buddha's talking about, it's very sobering, I tell you. Just look at that, you know. And without understanding the wisdom wing, which means without understanding karma, not to mention understanding the mind, we can't comprehend this level of compassion that Buddha talks about, you know. So let's unpack these words, because it's all very logical. Well, the word compassion, what is this? Well, remember we discussed the mental consciousness, and we've got these different categories of states of mind. The positive, the negative, and then the mechanics, if you like. I like to call it that. It's very helpful. So the positive and the negative are the key ones. We have to learn to distinguish between these. Because remember the word Buddha. Buddha implies get rid of all the rubbish. And Da implies developing to perfection all the goodness. So it's very evident that developing a Buddhist is to distinguish between the rubbish and the good stuff. But right now they're mixed together like a big soup, you know. We can't tell the difference. And also because it's quite shocking for us, because the logic in our culture, in our neuroscience and in our psychology, that a normal person has a bit of anger, a bit of love, a bit of depression, a bit of jealousy, a bit of kindness, hopefully some of the better ones, but to think that you actually can get rid of the rubbish ones or even begin to isolate them and lessen them, that's kind of radical. But that is the Buddhist approach. And if we don't understand that, we don't understand what Buddha's talking about, quite frankly. I mean, not being too cliches, but when you think it's all about mind, you know, being mindful and meditating and like this, yeah, but that's not the point. The reason you meditate, the reason you're mindful is so you can see your mind and distinguish the rubbish from the good stuff. And this is the hardest job we'll ever do, because you don't even look here, you know. That's junior school and high school. So, let's look at the word compassion. In the first category of states of mind are all the neurotic ones, the unhappy ones, the ego-based ones, the fear-based ones, the ones that cause us suffering and therefore cause us to do dumb things to harm others. And then the second category of states of mind, the virtues, the positive ones, the positive attitudes, the positive qualities. We know them backwards, you know, love, compassion, kindness, intelligence, joy. Joy is in another category, never mind that. But I mean these positive qualities we have to try and cultivate. So what's compassion? So you could argue the whole for compassion wing, and there it is, the word compassion is huge in Buddhism, as we know. So you've got love and compassion. They're like flip sides of the same coin. So love, defining love, all these states of mind are conceptual. The negative ones are misconceptions, and the virtuous ones are valid conceptions. But there are all these emotions and things, like we talked yesterday. We only notice what's happening in our mind when it's vomiting out the mouth. We only notice what's happening in our mind when our body's experiencing, when it's intense emotion. But that's, like we talked yesterday, that's way too late. It's like being 100 miles an hour on the freeway and you only now notice that your wheels are falling off. It's just literally too late, you know. And Buddha skills enable us to see what's going on in the conceptual level, in the thoughts that underpin the emotions. And this takes us time to even hear the meaning of that, you know. So the valid concepts, the valid states of mind, the valid emotions, love and compassion is the essence. So love is, you define it as a thought, starts with a thought. They all start with being a thought. Attachment is a thought, begins with a thought that exaggerates the deliciousness of something. And then it grows to intense emotion, as we know. Anger is a thought, a concept that exaggerates the ugliness of something. And that's the function of all the delusions. They exaggerate, they distort, they embellish. They cause us not to be in reality. Then the virtuous states of mind, the positive ones, the useful ones, the beneficial ones, the positive ones, the ones we can grow to perfection. They're also conceptual stories, but they're valid, they're in sync with reality. So love is a thought, it's a delight in someone else's happiness. You see someone happy, and your heart goes out to them, and you're happy for them. Whatever makes you happy, that's love, you know. Compassion, you see suffering, and you wish the person didn't have it. Empathy and compassion, pretty much, I mean, people in the West use these words differently. But compassion is seeing the pain of another, seeing them suffering, or indeed, at a deeper level, seeing them causing themselves suffering or causing others suffering. This is a crucial piece. and wishing they and had a, and wishing they weren't, wishing they didn't suffer. That's compassion. Now, if compassion is related to suffering, but if we have to, we have to know what Buddha means by that. So we've got to go right back to high school and go to the Four Noble Truths. So the Four Noble Truths, the Four Truths for the Noble Ones, Buddha's first teaching, okay? And it's his presentation, basically, of the world in terms of happiness and suffering. It's one way of framing the whole, the entirety of Buddhism as a system for stopping suffering and getting happiness. So clearly we've got to know what he means by that. So the first level of suffering, there's three kinds. The first noble truth is there is suffering. The second one is there are causes. The third is, guess what, folks, you can get rid of suffering and its causes. And fourth, how to do it. Very practical. So the first one, there is suffering. And if we don't understand this, then our compassion won't be valid. And this is what it's like now. It's not valid, right? It's better than nothing that we have now. We would never question our view of compassion. So the very first kind of suffering, Buddha calls it the suffering of suffering. The suffering of pain is like in-your-face suffering. Basically, being very brutal about it is when the bad things happen. And we get that. We understand that. You know, what we call, so this is where now the second kind of suffering is really depressing. The second kind of suffering is called the suffering of change, which means it doesn't last, which we know, but we don't quite get, you know, join the dots. But it's a bit shocking when we hear that what, if the first kind of suffering is when the bad things happen, the second kind of suffering, for Buddha, a more nuanced level of suffering, is when the good things happen. So in other words, when the good things happen, that's what we call happiness. So we look at our lives, we know since we're born, up until now, since we can remember, we can divide all of our experiences, this is exactly right, you check it out, we can divide all of our experiences into those that we liked, which we call happiness, and those we don't like, which we call suffering. That's about it. They argue there's a third level, which is, you know, when we discussed the word feeling yesterday, we'll go into this in depth, we need to understand this. There's a third category called neutral. But who cares about them? Forget them for now, please. Forget them. So the suffering of suffering, that's all we mean by suffering. That's our problem. That's the only one we can think of. That's when the bad things happen. And that's the one we know instinctively, and that's when attachment doesn't... Being brutal, like we talked yesterday, that's when attachment doesn't get what it wants. You know, all the way from the red light to the husband not putting the toilet seat down to being raped and murdered, you know. The suffering of suffering. And that's all we think of as suffering. So when we understand that, and then we think of compassion, and we look in the world, they're the only people we have compassion for. We have compassion for the people to whom bad things are happening. That's it. In other words, and then they need to be, pretty much they need to be innocent. I mean, if mean people suffer, we're almost happy for them. We don't think we have compassion for them. Because we tend to think, oh, they deserve it. You know, we have this different, whole different approach to it. So we only think of suffering as when the bad things happen. But for the Buddha, it's just the tip of the iceberg. It's just the grossest level. And there's these subtler, more nuanced levels of suffering. The second one is called the suffering of change. And the third, which is even more abstract for us, is actually called all pervasive suffering. So this is, and just understanding these three levels of suffering gives us the big picture in Buddhism. It gives us the entire view, you know. So there's two ways of talking about these. One is the big picture point of view, which is all the different realms of existence. You know, Buddha would assert there are trillions of sentient beings pervading existence, you know, trillions of sentient beings. And you can divide them all into different levels of mind, different levels of experience, mental experience, coming along with a certain kind of physicality and then coming along with a certain kind of environment. And he calls them realms of existence. So one way of looking at suffering and happiness, the three kinds of suffering, you know, we know that we're in what's called the desire realm, the realm of attachment that's caused by attachment. And the first two kinds of suffering are these. So the lower realms, as we know about, these are the three gross expressions or consequences of the three main delusions. So ignorance is the experience of that is the animal realm. Then you've got the intense suffering of attachment that's expressed as the spirit realm. Then you've got the hell realm. This is this bigger picture point of view of suffering. They're the lower realms. They're the suffering of suffering. Within the realms, they're the suffering of suffering. Then you've got the human realm and the God realms, a couple of those. That's called the upper realms, and they're the suffering of change. They're better than nothing. They're better than the other stuff, but they're still locked in suffering because the happiness we do get doesn't last, and then it turns into the first kind of suffering. So it's like tricky, you know? And then the third kind of suffering, all pervasive suffering, this is two other realms of existence that's referring to the different levels of beings from the Hindu perspective, and these are subtle states of concentration. They're all in samsara, and the characteristic that defines all of them is this ego grasping. As long as you've got ego grasping, you're in samsara. And you can have the grossest level of suffering, the middle kind of suffering, and the subtlest of suffering, but you're still in samsara. The Buddha's method is to get rid of all of them. So now that's one way of presenting the whole thing. But let's look at it in terms of our own life, because that's much more realistic for us. And that's another way of describing. We can see perfectly well in this life we've got the suffering of suffering and the suffering of change. So what I'm getting at here is that when we understand these in the wisdom wing, when we understand these in high school, we will begin to have renunciation of our own suffering. We are sick of suffering and its causes. And this is by the understanding of suffering, and then the second noble truth, the causes of it, this tells us the method. And understanding this deeply for ourselves gives us the wish to get the hell out of this suffering. Then and now we have a basis for having valid compassion for others. Once we understand the causes of suffering, which is karma and delusions. So karma is this, I mean, we haven't talked much about it, and I'm sure we're going to at some point throughout our time together. Might even come now, you know. This is huge. This is, you know, without understanding karma, we don't really understand Buddhism. And this is not the way the world thinks. This is not the Western view. The vast majority of people who call themselves Buddhists in the West don't ever think about karma and have not the slightest interest. Just think of it in this life, you know, learning to watch your mind, become a bit more mindful, become more happy, nothing wrong, but it's not the meaning of Buddhism at all. So to understand karma, this natural law that for Buddha is the law within which the whole universe runs. It's the law that runs the universe. Or it's the law within which the world runs. Like the law of botany, everything that grows runs within that law, just naturally. There's no garden outside the law of botany. Or there's no sentient being outside the law of karma. There's no being, there's no experience outside the law of karma. It's the law that Buddha has identified as the law that runs the universe. Or the law within which our lives are governs our lives. And it's all in terms of happiness and suffering. Happiness and suffering. So there's trillions upon trillions upon trillions upon trillions of sentient beings, the Buddha's big picture view. And we're either in existences that are the gross level of suffering, the medium level of suffering, or the subtlest level of suffering. And as soon as you realize emptiness, you know, that's the turning point. You're climbing out of your samsara into your nirvana. You haven't got there yet, you've got way to go, but you can never fall back after that. That's the distinctive, that's the defining characteristic of distinguishing between samsara and not samsara, you know. So karma, when we understand karma and delusions, which are the two causes of suffering and the second noble truth, there is suffering, three kinds. Then there are causes, and there are two main causes. Hundreds of causes. Buddha says the law of cause and effect runs the universe. It runs the universe. It's a natural law. He didn't make it up. He's not a creator. He didn't discover it. He didn't kind of invent it. He observed it with his mind. He observed it as the natural law. I always said this, I'm sure, maybe I said it yesterday, maybe I didn't. No, I didn't. I mean, I say it all the time. This scientist in New Zealand years ago asked me, he said, who revealed the teachings to the Buddha? Now, that's a perfect question within the framework of the usual world's view of religion, which is a philosophical view that presents a creator. Because, you know, a religion that posits a creator, the information is revelation. It comes from on high. Who revealed the teachings? It's a perfect question. When you come, and most of us don't question like this. We don't analyze, and we just seem to have the same assumption. We sort of know Buddha's not a creator, but we still think of it in the same way. We still think of it as something you have to believe, that someone made up, you know, like that. Not like that. Not like that. So when I said to this man, would you ask Einstein who revealed the teachings about relativity to him? He was completely shocked, and he laughed, and everyone laughed, you know. Of course he wouldn't. And that's the point here. Automatically, when we think spiritual, we think belief. Belief implies can't prove. Belief implies revelation from on high, sent down to us. And that's not the Buddha's view. Nothing like that. There's something like that. Sure, you can say there's revelation when you're a highly advanced yogi who's realized emptiness, nirvana, bodhisattva, in the depth and subtlety of your meditation. You will definitely see the Buddha at a subtle level, but it's the same really as seeing him at a gross level. Your mind is cognizing it directly, you know. But revelation implies it's knowledge kind of popped into you, you know, kind of injected into you, suddenly comes out of nowhere. No, of course not. So Buddha then is presenting how he sees the universe. And his essential point, one way of framing all the Buddhism, as I said, is in terms of happiness and suffering. Another way of framing it is in terms of getting wisdom and stopping ignorance. And this is his main point, that why we suffer is because we're not in touch with reality. Why we suffer is because we're not in touch with reality. That's what he says, you know. Why we suffer is because we're living in la-la land. So as far as he's concerned, then one way of pushing why we suffer is in due to past, there's hundreds of causes. There are hundreds of causes for everything. It's the natural law of cause and effect. Everywhere you go, everything you turn into a cup, a flower, a lamp, anything. It has many, many causes that have to come together in order for it to manifest. Even the simplest thing, you know, there are many causes that have to come together. That's pretty evident. But what Buddha's saying here in terms of happiness and suffering, but we can imply it for happiness as well. As far as he's concerned, there are two main causes. And the crucial point, the word is main. Like I said yesterday, when you study Buddhist philosophy, you learn many kinds of causes. You know, substantial and direct and indirect and secondary and blah, 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 like this. So as far as we are concerned, with our samsaric view, ego's view, there's one cause of my suffering, and it's probably Donovan being mean to me, you know. And equally, there's one cause of my happiness, it's Donna when she's kind to me. And that's attachment and aversion's view. That completely gets us to see that, right? But he says, no, there's two main causes of suffering, and therefore we can also say two main causes of happiness. And they're both inside us. That's the part that's hard to hear. That's the part that's so outrageously shocking to us. We might know these words for 47 years, but it's very hard to internalize this. We say it, we repeat it, but to actually experience that, to practice that, is intensely, unbelievably, profoundly difficult, you know? So these two main causes are the past action, because every millisecond of whatever any mind thinks and does and says, necessarily every millisecond without going astray, leaves a seed in the mind. It's an action, and that's a mental action. The action first of body and speech, driven by a delusion, driven by a state of mind. So the main cause of Donna being kind to me, she's merely the catalyst. She's not the main cause, but she's a secondary cause. She's a catalyst. Her kind words, to me, I'm the main cause of that. From past virtue, a past virtuous action to Donna, karma's pretty personal, driven by a virtue. So the main cause of happiness is karma and virtue. The main cause of suffering is action and delusion. So the main cause of Donna being mean to me is because the past action I did like that, driven by a delusion. The words are extremely simple. These are like simple English words. Anyone could repeat them pretty quickly. But to actually internalize the reality of that is a profound practice. Not because it's difficult in its nature. No, it's only because we're addicted to the opposite. Believing that she's the main cause of my suffering and I'm an innocent victim. And she's the main cause of my happiness and I'm an innocent victim as well for that. So we get this in high school. So when we've got that in high school, we have the basis of understanding why we are suffering. And so that tells us the solution. I think, do I want to be killed in the future? Do I want to be lied to? And I answer no. So then I've got to see what is the cause of it. And the cause of you know, the cause of, okay, sorry, before we go there, sorry. So one bigger picture is the seeing of suffering as the realms of existence, but the other one is within this life, which is much more manageable for us, you know. So like we said, I'm sure we did yesterday, I can't remember, but here we're talking about it again. There are four ways, four tracks of our karma, four ways in which our past actions ripen in the present. And if we can just get this with karma, we really have a basis to judging our life, for interpreting our life, ours and others. And they're very clear, distinctive areas of experience. So the first one, the first result of our past karma is the type of body we've got, whether a lion or a mosquito or a human. In our case, we're human. So we won the lottery in a sense, although it's not a lottery, it's not good luck, it's due to hard work. And it's the result of virtue, in particular non-killing, practiced, as Lama Zopa says, in the framework of a spiritual practice, but not even only that, but practiced in the context of keeping vows of morality. Lama Zopa says this. Being good is not enough, he says. So we've got this human life. Now within this life, the other three ways of our karma ripen, the three ways. And it's not complicated. We just remember it. It's the three tracks of karma. So what these are the next one. So the one, the first of those three, is called. You can say it's called our mental tendencies. We all say we've got a human body. Well, so is Hitler, and so is Mother Teresa. And you see, there's a spectrum between them, isn't there? From being nice to being mean. Think of it. But they both share the fact of a human body. So they both had a virtuous karmic seed of non-killing triggered at the time of their past death, in which case they both, their mind went to a mummy's human womb. That's the same for both of them. Now, where's the difference? Is the next one. It's their mental tendencies, their personality traits. That's the difference, isn't it? So clearly Hitler was born with a bunch of wacky tendencies, you know, kind of power megalomaniac and really distorted philosophical views, and had the power to harm many millions of people. So clearly they're his tendencies from his past habits. Mother Teresa seems like the opposite, you know, runs around helping people. We can see this. So we've all got a bit of both, I mean, maybe not extreme like those two. So we have some negative tendencies and we have some positive tendencies. And again, remember, being a Buddhist is the job. The job is to distinguish between this lot. That's it. That's the essence of it. So we've got these tendencies. That's the first way our karma has ripened. In other words, they do not come from our parents. This is super, super clear for the Buddha. Crystal clear. These tendencies of ours that we express in this life, they were triggered weeks before we found anywhere near our mother, when we were anywhere near our mother. In our own past life, at the time of our death, these various karmic seeds that programmed us to go to that mother's womb and programmed us to have the experiences we had in this life, they were triggered before we even went there. They were triggered in the past life still. So we've got nothing to do with the parents. Doesn't mean the parents haven't got them. I mean, I was sick, you know, close. My mother was a musician. And then she could see that a little Bobsy, me, had a tendency to be good at music. So naturally we assume I've got my mother's genes. So she got her music from her mummy, we say, you know. But for the Buddha, it's not like that. My mother was born with a tendency to be good at music. She must have practiced it before. I was born with a tendency to be good at music, supposedly. My mum says so. Because I must have practiced it before. And we conveniently came together where she saw it in me and she taught me, so she nourished my seeds. She didn't give me music. That's the difference. That's the difference. You know? You might have fascist tendencies, you know, be a racist and mean and deluded and fundamentalist. And you know, we all think that your mother trained you in that. No, she didn't. She might also be that way, but you had those tendencies as well. And you got conveniently born to her, where you just nourished each other's tendencies. If you didn't have those tendencies, she couldn't have forced you to be. If I didn't have a tendency to be good at music, my mother could have taught me music 24 hours a day, and I would never have learned. So it's a simple point that the first way within this life that our karma ripens, and this is where our responsibility really starts to grow. These are my tendencies. This is my anger, my love, my depression, my kindness, my being good at music. And this is the one that takes a long time to get, because we are convinced it all comes from out there. Just convinced. Completely convinced, you know. It's triggered by stuff out there, no problem. That's called actions or intentions or tendencies similar to the cause, or of our habits, you know. Now the next one is called experiences similar to the cause. And basically, really simply, this is all, since we're born until now, this is the way we've been seen and treated by others. It's really simple. Think of your life. Since you're born, you could divide all your experiences in relation to others as happy or unhappy experiences. Think about it. You've been either harmed or helped. That's it. That's called experiences similar to the cause. The way you're seen and treated by others. And that's where, because we assume there's a direct relationship between if I'm a good person, then why would bad things happen to me? It makes no sense to us. We assume there's a natural relationship between these two, not to the Buddha. Equally, we wonder why, so you can be a good person and have bad things happen to you, but for sure, you can be a bad person and have good things happen to you. And this seems so, this is one of our fundamental questions, this seems so shocking and, as we would say, unfair. There are two tracks of karma, two separate bank vaults full of scenes from past lives. They don't have a direct relationship at all. You can see there is a relationship. Let's say, the first one is the intentions in your mind, the tendencies, and the second one is your experiences at the hands of others. We'll go into more detail. The third one is, it's called environmental karma. It's very curious, this one, environmental karma, you know. We see we've got a human body, we see we've got tendencies, and we see that people see us a certain way. But we don't float in the sky, do we? We have a ground we live in, and we have environments, and they impact upon us as well. So the way the environment impacts upon us, like, is harmful or disgusting or healthy or beautiful or ugly. Main cause of that? Our past actions. All of our experiences at the hands of others, whether they hate us or love us or treat us beautifully or not, main cause of all that? Our past actions. All your tendencies, good or bad, main cause of that? Your past tendencies. So it's really not complicated, but it's very shocking. I mean, this whole Dalai Lama says it's self-creation. It's a shocking concept. I mean, if you're a materialist and if you're a Christian, the one thing you share is that someone else made you. Someone else plonked you on this planet. That's a nutty idea for the Buddha. And that's where he radically differs. I mean, radically differs from all the philosophical views on the planet. Or the popular religions anyway, certainly that. You know, if you're a materialist, you check yourself back to mummy and grandma and grandpa and the monkey, doesn't it? That's where we look for the causes. If you're a Christian, you track yourself back to God. In neither case. Mummy and daddy give us a body, no problem. But our creator has no role whatsoever. Buddha says we don't need creating. We do fine making our own mess, and we can do fine making our own happiness. We're in charge. We're the boss. This is a very shocking concept for us. It takes us so long to hear this. So the point I'm getting at here is until I get this sorted out, until I start to take responsibility for my own rubbish and my own pain and my own happiness, and especially the suffering one, because that energizes me to want to get rid of it. That's what I mean by renunciation. You renounce. You give up suffering and its causes. And why would you? Because you don't want suffering. It's hardly a no-brainer. That is the basis for compassion for others. The view we have now of compassion is only for the people the bad things happen to, and they've got to be innocent. I mean, if you see someone beating a dog up and the dog bites the guy, you're not going to feel sorry for that guy. You'll be happy he's being beaten. He's got what he deserved, you know. So we have this dualistic view of punishment and reward, innocent and not innocent, you know. So our compassion is reserved just for the innocent ones. That's usually children and a few animals. It's about it, you know, practically. Very, very profoundly limited for the Buddha. So that's why it's not possible in the title, Thought Transformation, this more advanced level of compassion, where you actually learn to greet the problems with a happy mind, where you're glad you're being abused, where you're glad when bad things happen. I mean, it sounds schizophrenic, doesn't it? There's no way in the universe we can understand that if we don't have a valid view of compassion. And there's no way in the world we can have valid compassion for everybody until we have renunciation, until we understand renunciation, which is high school. Not possible. Just not possible. Very simple. And we can't get renunciation properly in high school until we understand karma, which is junior school. So it's all very structured and logically connected. And if we miss a piece, it'll all just be, there'll be no logic to it, and we'll get so confused. In other words, you know, when I mentioned the story of the young nuns, those Tibetan nuns who are abused, sexually abused and tortured. The only way they can have that level of compassion when they said at the end, I mentioned that yesterday, didn't I? People? Did I mention it yesterday? I did. Thank you very much. The only way to comprehend what they're saying, you know, is you understand karma. And that for them, as I said, the Tibetans have been in their bones for 1,200 years. It's just natural. It's their view of the universe. Like materialism is our natural view, you know. And that's the one, I mean, I always... Okay. I always, you know, I quote that. Remember, where's Andre? Is Andre here? Where's Andre? Or is he on YouTube? Are you here, Andre? Can't see Andre. Anyway, just years ago in there he is. There's Andre. I'm going to tell that story, Andre. Remember, are you hearing me properly, Andre? Can you hear me? Andre, can you hear me? He's not nodding. He's not nodding. It means he can't hear me. God. He texted him or something. Andre, can you hear me, honey? Why is he not nodding? I mean, he's not hearing me.
Yes.
He said yes. Okay, good. Okay, I'll tell a story. Okay, good, Andre. I'll tell that story, honey. Remember that story? Remember you came to that conference that we had in San Francisco in 2008? Yes. And we had a little Inner Happiness conference. Yes. And we invited Andre and one other lady from somewhere.
I'm hearing you. Yes.
Yeah, I'm very happy. Very good.
Hear you.
I'm happy, honey.
I do.
I'm happy you hear me, Andre. Good. Now I'm going to tell a story. So you can tell me. Mute yourself. There you go. He's muted now. Okay, the story is this. There's this white woman, Christian woman, and then there's Andre, and Andre's a Buddhist, okay? And they were both having a talk, and it was about sort of, you know, restorative justice, about how you go to, you know, to try and heal the business between the victims and the naughty people, right? So this woman's daughter had been raped and murdered, and Andre, as some of you might know, his son was murdered. And they were both talking about their own experiences. So this is, you know, so the Christian is very powerful. I mean, this woman became a Christian and she met the murderer of her, one of the murderers of her child, her daughter who was 16, who was raped and then murdered. And I remember the story. It was something like this one boy out of his brain, two friends out of their brain on drugs, and they raped the girl, and they were convinced they had to kill her. So they, I mean, I think she told the story. She really had wanted to meet. This boy, she really wanted to meet the murderer of her child, and he did too. He was so moved to meet the mother, you know, beg forgiveness. And he told the story. He said that after they raped her, he then got to shoot her to death. And she looked him in the eye, and she said, "I forgive you, and God does too." Now that's a pretty profound level of compassion, isn't it? It's pretty unbelievable. I mean, that's just outrageous. It was about to be murdered. And she says that to this boy. And she tells that to the mother. So moving. But I remember Andre's story, you know, it's another level, but it's a Buddhist approach in a way. And this is the point here. Andre, he was on the telly that night. He was on the television news after his son had been stabbed to death in a bar. And he was asked what he thought of the murderer of his boy. Well, Andre said, "How could I not have compassion?" He said, "This boy's suffering is only just beginning." And this is the point here. This is the point about compassion from the Buddhist point of view. That boy who stabbed his boy, his suffering is only just beginning. Now, Andre knows that, and I know that, because we work in prison with the murderers. You know, we know, and you see these real human beings who've had this garbage life or whatever, and then due to some connection, some karma happening, they kill somebody. You understand? So it's when you know that person one-on-one and you see their heart and you hear them and their regret and their pain, it's evident to see there's a real human being there. But but until we have that understanding that the person who does the harm, as Andre said, I'll never forget that, he said, his suffering is only just beginning. And it's true. His suffering is only just beginning. But that's hard to have that view. And certainly in the Buddhist view, that's impossible to have that view without understanding karma. And Andre would have known, he would have understood that his own boy had the karma to be stabbed to death. And they had this personal relationship. Karma is so personal, you know. You can't be killed by a person you haven't harmed before. You cannot have one person be kind to you if you haven't encountered them before. Of course, this is so shocking for us. The concept of karma is weird in our culture, you know. So, but we can't really begin to understand Buddhism from the big picture point of view, and we can't really get the big picture understanding of compassion unless we factor in this view of karma. Which, of course, all we can do with it is hypothesize it, take it as your presentation. We're going to prove it eventually, or disprove it, you know, but just swallow it whole. But it explained, that's why those young Tibetan nuns. And of course, they said, they raped and tortured for years in prison. And of course, they said, one of them said at the end, we had compassion for our torturers. One, they didn't say one, I'm saying it, because we knew we must have harmed them in the past. I mean, this is insane in our culture. And two, and this is the real point, because we knew they would suffer in the future. That's the real point about real compassion. They said the bodhisattvas and the Buddhas have such compassion for all of us because we don't realize that what we do now is cause our future suffering. We absolutely do not have that view. We are even in this life, we don't see it. I mean, we understand this view so easily when it comes to food. We know perfectly well, you go to the doctor and she says, you've got to stop eating all that sugar, you'll get diabetes in 20 years. We understand the long-term view just within a lifetime. But we have, and it's very fascinating, we're very intelligent when it comes to understanding the relationship between what we do now to our body and what our body will be like in the future. That's called science, and we get it, and we're super skillful. But we have these bizarre ideas about the mind. We have no sense that my anger now or my compassion now produces the person of the future. We don't have any view like that. It's very, very odd, you know. It's very strange. In fact, even as Lama Zopa said, the vast majority of all humans on this planet have absolutely no idea that what goes on in their mind, not to mention their actions, what goes on in their mind plays any role at all in their life. And I'm not using this word lightly. Lama Yeshe would often use it. That's schizophrenic. That's so disconnected. We are so disconnected from what's happening in here and the person we are. We really do really believe that all this conspiracy theories out there, and that is what has produced me. And this sense of utter victim and utter hopelessness and utter despair, because we just do not realize we have any, we play any role at all. I mean, that is, if that's not suffering, I don't know what is. You know, so disconnected, so utterly disconnected, you know. That's intensity of our suffering. That's the function of ego grasping, you know, the root delusion. So beginning to think about karma starts to break that one down. It demands we take responsibility. I am the fruit of what I've done. I mean, if you go to the doctor and you get lung cancer and all you do is try and sue Marlboro, that's fine, try and sue Marlboro. But believing that you're this innocent victim, that you played no role in this, is just not true. You did. You chose to smoke. We don't like to hear that, though. We say it's not my fault. That's how we are. That's the intensity of our suffering. That's the disconnect that we have. And so it's powerful to gradually take on this view of karma, that we begin to realize that we are the cause of ourselves. It's an amazingly powerful view, and it's so grown up, you know. And that's when our suffering starts to stop. That's what's interesting. That's when our suffering starts to stop. We start to realize we're in charge, you know. And we can own the things we've done and said, good and bad. So the suffering of suffering is when the bad things happen in this life, and they're the result of negative actions. So the suffering of suffering is when bad things happen. So when bad things happen for us, there's two things. There's the environmental suffering and the experiences similar to the cause. So when bad things happen to us now, or Buddha's view is when someone's mean to you, when someone lies to you, there's a very specific cause. You must have lied to them. Or you tell the truth, but they don't believe you. That's the way I think we suffer most in our life. When the bad things happen to us, when patently in this life we didn't do anything. We did not do anything in this life, definitely. We know that. We never met that bloke on the street who punches me in the nose. It's very clear. That's why we suffer so stupendously. And that's why those young women in Tibet did not have that kind of suffering. They never had the question, why is this happening to me? Which is the main way we suffer. Because we don't have a memory of past lives, obviously. And we feel like an innocent victim. This is the way we suffer so terribly. And the second way, which sounds odd, is environmental karma. So strange to hear that one. The way the physical world impacts upon you is due to your past actions as well. So when we understand this, then we have a basis for having compassion, just like those young women. you know, or just like Andre for his son, you know. The murder of his own son. His suffering has just begun, he said. That's fact. So the thing is too, until we come to terms with this, until we understand our own mind, until we do lots of the wisdom wing work, until we delve deep inside and see our own pain, which means our own attachment, our own anger, our own jealousy, our own fears, our own despair, our own depression, until we understand this, and we often don't because we don't really study the Buddhist view of the mind, but if we did, it would help us understand it. Because we are so addicted. We know about the depression and the anger and the jealousy, but we're so addicted to believing that the thing out there caused it, that mummy over there and the boyfriend here caused it. So we know there's depression, but we have got a wrong analysis of the causes. That's really what Buddha's saying. Yes, Donna was mean thing. You saw it. She was. But she's not the main cause. That's the point. My mind is the main cause. My past actions and my delusions, you know, that's the one. So until we understand that model of the mind, it's very distinct. Buddha's view is very distinct. To understand it, even intellectually, we're not going to quite get it, you know, we won't understand. And that's where we have to understand that all these emotions we've got, we call them emotions. This is a massive point for Buddhism. Like the point yesterday, we only know, the typical question we ask is, what will I do if I'm angry with my boyfriend? That's like asking, what will I do if I'm 100 miles an hour and the wheels are falling off? The best you can do is damage control and then learn from it and go back to basics and realize there are methods to start to notice the problems in the mind when the wheels begin to wobble. We get with the body, we start to see things going wrong with our body, so we have maintenance. We go to the dentist. We adjust our eating habits. We notice the wheels wobbling. But when it comes to our mind, we do not, because we don't pay attention until the words are vomiting out our mouth. We don't pay attention until we are inert in bed with depression. It's only then that we notice. And our problem is because we refer to them as emotions. But the Buddha's point is all these emotions, angry emotions or loving emotions, that's when the body's involved. That's when we feel it in our body. And because we're so addicted to our body, we make the body the boss, as Lama Yeshe says. We don't notice the millions of thoughts throughout a day that are quietly chatting away until they start to shout. Because we don't pay attention here. And that's Buddha's great expertise. He gives us skills to find the skills to pay attention internally so we can begin to hear all these conceptual stories, these elaborate conceptual stories, chatting away 1,000 thoughts a second, you know. That's when we really become our own therapist. And that's when the wheels are wobbling. And then you could say when you start to practice at that level and you grab the stories before they start to grow, you could say you'd never have a mental breakdown. You'd never get to the point of being inert with depression. You'd never get to the point of screaming and shouting uncontrollably. I mean, that's advanced already. Because you're working with the mind at a subtler level, hearing the conceptual stories that are that underpin, that inform, that cause the emotional experiences. They're utterly connected. We only really begin to see that when we start to get some concentration, you know. Then we can have compassion for others. Only then. Not possible otherwise. Because our compassion is mixed with anger. That's the trouble. We see someone suffering, we have compassion, and then the next second we try to find who to blame, which turns into anger. That's the difficulty. This is where it's so hard to imagine all the way the world is now with crazy politicians and terrible things happening. We can't imagine how you can't get angry. This is very, very, very strange for us, you know. Because we don't really have a proper analysis. We don't. If we compare with Buddha's analysis, we don't have the same analysis at all. We don't have a finer way of looking at the various parts of our mind, you know. So what, for us now, especially if we're political activists, we conflate anger with compassion. When we love a person, we can place attachment with compassion. This is our biggest problem, and this is a brilliant skill we have to learn if we say we want to be a Buddhist. We have to learn to distinguish between delusions and virtues, between facts and fictions. This is the job from here to Buddhahood of a Buddhist. This often does not, we don't get this one often until we really begin to understand the Buddhist mind, view of the mind, you know. But for us, it mixed like a big emotion, mixed like a big soup, all mixed together because we don't pay attention, you know. So anger is the result of thwarted attachment. My attachment is this junkiness that is frantic to get only the nice things every millisecond. Another way to put it, it's frantic to get only what I want. Only what I want. It's utterly and completely self-centered. And it's definitely frantic. It's like it's a junkie, frantic. And the thing is, the millisecond that attachment is thwarted, the millisecond that attachment doesn't get what it wants, and it's 1,000 times a day, that second is the panic attack of aversion, which can either be anger, irritation, or internally despair and depression, depending on the personality you've got. And this is utterly and completely instinctive because we've practiced it for eons and eons, Buddha says. And this is referring to all the animal realm as well, all the spirits, all the helpings. This view of the mind refers to all living beings, this analysis. So if I have an attachment, which is the assumption that I must get what I want every second. So then also alongside that, we will also have compassion. There's no question. So, you know, I always use my own example when I was a political activist. So when I was a radical lefty first, then the people I had compassion with were the poor people. They were the poor people. So naturally, with a political view, you look for the people who caused it, which is the rich people. The imbalance of it all. So I definitely had compassion for the poor people. But because my analysis said that the rich people are the cause, then my compassion then led to anger for that group. That's the normal way we think of this world. Look at wars. What do you think a war is? It's one group of people, and you hurt my people, so I have compassion for my people, and I hate you. It's completely natural. We never even question this. There's my people and your people. So when I had compassion for the poor people, and I was a radical lefty, going with that political view, I definitely did have compassion. It was very true. I did have compassion. But it was polluted by my attachment, because my attachment to my view, I was right. And then there's the more the bad things happen to the poor people, the next instant is the analysis of how dare the rich do this and that, and you criticize and get angry and point the fingers. So what happens? So there's the virtue. A virtue was compassion. There's no question it was there. I did have compassion. But the deluded side, I had attachment. Attachment to my view, and attachment also more broadly was attachment only, because it only can only bear the nice things. Attachment only wants the nice things to happen. It only wants the nice things. Only wants the nice things, ever. It can't cope with anything that isn't nice. It's really like that. So the second, then with that mind, and I had this political view, the second I saw the suffering, the second I saw the poor people, the second I saw all these suffering people at the hands of all the rich people, my compassion came, yes, but what I couldn't see was my attachment wasn't getting what it wanted. So that's what caused the anger. But we conflate them. Attachment is the junkie in me that only wanted to see what I wanted to see, and the particular analysis what I couldn't, therefore I couldn't stand to see the poor people. So then that was anger, and that was anger, that was anger. But I thought it was compassion. So I'd rush off and demonstrate and shout and yell and get arrested and, you know, kick the police and the whatever. I shouldn't say that. I might get thrown out of America. They might find me out. It was a long time ago. I've got a passport. I'm an American. So. So we don't notice the difference. We just don't think this way in our psychological models. So attachment is a junkie in me that wants only what I want. So then I've got this political view that interprets everything in a very certain way, so I want everything to be like that. And the second I meet anybody who disagrees, anger arises. And that's so the anger was polluting my compassion. And we think we need anger to act. So that's over-exaggerating the power of anger. Buddha would say, no, you don't need anger to act. You need intelligence, dear. Don't be silly. As a Dalai Lama one time was asked by a journalist, you know, the journalist said, well, it seems like anger is a very strong motivator to act. And Dalai Lama said, I know what you mean. It's true. But he said, if it's really mainly anger, which is how dare you do that, you're evil, you're this, it's shouting and yelling, it's inflating, and it's artificial. And as Dalai Lama said, it won't last. If it's mainly anger, it won't last. But if it's compassion, you never give up. That's not the Martin Luther King statement. For me, I find it mind-blowing. There he was out there, this constant political activity, putting his life on the line every second. You could see he wasn't angry. But I know at the time, I thought he was a wimp. I preferred Malcolm X, you know? Do you understand? Like the raging, shouting, yelling ones. I mean, I love Malcolm X still. He was an amazing human being. But, you know, and this was a book recently I read that said actually Malcolm X and Martin Luther King actually were more similar than people thought. But in the end of their lives, they were really almost on the same track, you know. But they both came from different directions. But I remember, you know, Martin Luther King, he did not get angry. You could see he was very patient. He was constantly proactive. And as he said, when you see something wrong, he even said the word, it's good to be angry. He meant it's good to find fault. Which means, oh my God, look at the racism. Look at the sexism. Look at the suffering. But then you say, what can I do to help? This is so interesting in all the papers and all in the YouTubes and all the reports lately, the last week, with all the demonstrations. The number of people who talk this way, ordinary people who've never been to a demonstration in their life, they said they saw it. They were brokenhearted, and you know, like white people as well as black, but the white ones as well. But one woman who's never been to any demonstration, kept one of her two children with her. She said, I had to do something. And she wasn't going to loot and riot. She had compassion. I felt I had to do something. So Martin Luther King said, you see the suffering and then you say, what can I do to help? That's compassion. You don't need anger to do that. Anger just rants and raves. It makes a mess half the time and over-exaggerates everything. You've got no patience. You can't, you know, you can't talk to people. You just end up making a mess. You don't need anger to notice something suffering there. You need to be shocked by it and moved by it. That's called compassion. That's called compassion. And it drives you to action. Of course, that's too high for all of us because we've all got attachment, which means we've all got anger. But at least if we can distinguish between them and try to grow the compassion side and never stop acting as well, never stop working and helping, that's powerful. I mean, we've all got anger right now. We can't not have it until we're highly advanced. So we accept that we've got it, but we have to distinguish the difference and see it. And see, when the stronger the anger, the more crazy you become, you know. The more crazy. They're completely different states of mind. So the Buddha's analysis of these different states of mind is quite nuanced, you know. It's quite refined. It's quite subtle. And again, it's not the analysis we use in the West, so we have to understand it properly if we want to understand Buddhism, assuming we choose to, you know. And that's why when all our emotions are mixed together like a big soup, they all come out at once, all together, we can't really tell the difference between compassion and anger. We just can't, you know. Now, the same with love and attachment. That's even more subtle, more profound. Now, I'm in love with, say, somebody. I'm in love with Fred, let's say, you know. Initially, that's 99% attachment. This is good. This is what we can talk about now. Let's just look at the first practice we practice when we do the compassion wing. You know, the first level of realizations is the junior school and high school, and that's renunciation, renouncing suffering and its causes, and that is like compassion for yourself. This is very profound. Now, the next level on the compassion wing, the next level of realization is bodhicitta. This outrageous attitude. It's not equivalent to compassion at all. It's the culmination of compassion. So these techniques we know, these 11 or 7, two different styles of techniques. One called exchanging self for others, and another one called the 7 causes and effects. The one cause and 7 result, 7 cause, 6 causes and 1 result or something, 7 point something. These two methods that culminate in the achievement of bodhicitta. And what bodhicitta is, it's this profound shift in your mind where now others are in the front of your mind and you're second, you're behind. This is even just those simple words, even the idea of bodhicitta is just absurd in our culture, you know. It seems inhuman. We can't fit it into our psychology. It doesn't make sense. Which is why we do the high school work of distinguishing delusions and virtues. It's fundamentally necessary. So that that is the result of incredible levels of compassion and incredible levels of love, which come from and are tracked back to this fundamental basic technique that's called developing equanimity. This is the foundation, and this is really important to understand logically. Otherwise, we won't understand how you can get bodhicitta. Not possible. So equanimity is very powerful because it takes the three poisons: ignorance, attachment and aversion. Like we said, there's a summary of those 84,000 that Buddha has, like this map of the mind that Buddhism has. So these three, the objects, so in high school we learn all about the delusions, but here in the compassion wing, we're looking at these delusions in terms of the sentient beings. So in the high school one, we're trying to control attachments to, you know, sex and drugs and rock and roll sort of thing. Here, we're trying to understand the way the delusions frame all the sentient beings in this world. We see them either as friends, enemies, or strangers. And there's no fourth category on this planet because these are the objects of the three delusions, the objects of the three poisons. And this is in all the realms of existence as well. This view of the mind refers to all sentient beings in the universe, all the animals, the dogs, the hell beings, the spirits, the gods, everybody. It's a pretty coherent, integrated view, you know, of all beings in the universe. And these three poisons summarize everything. So here, what we need to do is, in order to really begin to develop genuine love and compassion and great compassion in bodhicitta, we have to have this understanding of equanimity. It's fundamental. Without it, love and compassion for all sentient beings is a nonsense. So, okay. Equanimity, then, such that when you've got it, is a heartfelt recognition that enemy, friend, and enemy and stranger, three people. Friend is the object of attachment. Enemy is the object of aversion. We mightn't use the word enemy, but it's a convenient label here for the people we don't like. Friend is the object of attachment. Enemy is the object of aversion. And stranger is the object of indifference, which is one of the aspects of ignorance. A manifestation of ignorance is indifference. So I'm attached to the ones who do what I want, their friends. So those are the ones I have love for, and those are the ones I have compassion for. As Lama Zopa says, we do have love and compassion, but only for that lot. Pretty much only for that lot. But as Rinpoche says, it's unstable because it's based on attachment. Or as we say, it's got strings attached. Then aversion, anger, is what you have for the people whom we can label here enemy, who are those who have not done what my attachment wants, who have done what my attachment doesn't want. So they are called enemies, and I have anger or aversion towards them. People, as we're talking, we should visualize these people in front of us, you know. Well, the third category, 99.99% of the universe, they are called strangers. And who are they? They've neither harmed us nor helped us. So how do we feel about them? Could not care less. They could all drop dead. This is a fact. This is the world. This is the universe. Because it's the three poisons that run everything. So it's very convenient. It's a very sort of structured, logical presentation. It's incredible. It's so uncomplicated, you know. So equanimity, this equanimity, there's different levels of equanimity. Equanimity here is this heartfelt recognition that the friend and the enemy and the stranger are equal to each other from one point of view. It's very precise. We mix it up and make it all kind of gooey and sentimental. It's a very precise state of mind. It's the recognition that the friend, the enemy, and the stranger are equal to each other from one point of view. They each equally want to be happy. They each equally do not want suffering. That's it. That's equanimity. It doesn't mean you love everybody and blah, 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 and all kind of soupy and rubbish. It's a very precise definition, and that's the basis, the absolute basis, upon which we can stably build love, compassion, great compassion, bodhicitta. So why is it the foundation? It's very logical. Right now, we have love, but only for the first group. Occasionally for a stranger. If you read about them, it might touch your heart, you know. And we do have compassion, but usually only for the first group. In other words, our compassion and love are contingent. As long as you do what I want, as long as Don is nice to me, and there's nothing mean about us, we are all like this. It is natural. Don't get guilty. It's samsara, you know. As long as Donna says the lovely words and looks after me and is kind to me, and there's nothing wrong with a wonderful thing to have a good relationship. Yes, so blessed to have a relationship. But if my attachment's really strong, frantic to get what I want every second. The moment Donna's unkind, look at us. I mean, look at us. Complete panic attack. And sometimes it doesn't take much at all to totally take her out of your life. And you'll never forget that one bad thing she did. You won't forgive her. Some people don't forgive her 50 years, you know, we're so hurt, the injured. And I mean, she might have been mean. I'm not saying she didn't. But this is because we have attachment that is frantic to get everything out there. All the people have to do what I want, look the way I like, sound the way I like, eat the way I like the music I like the football I like. There's no tolerance because they're so fragile. There's no tolerance for anything outside that. Look at the universe. It's called friends, enemies, and strangers. Monkeys, dogs, ants, humans. It is natural because these are the three poisons, you know. And we don't question them. So, I do have love and I do have compassion, but it's contingent on this, on attachment. So therefore, the moment Donna stops doing what I want, being mean to me, she will now go into the enemy category because she has stopped doing what my attachment wants. So now I don't love her and I don't have compassion for her and I might even have to struggle to actually not want, to try and not hate her, you know? We know that. Now the point about this is, it's very shocking, the point about this is she might have been horrible. This is the point. It doesn't mean they're all equal in wanting to be happy, therefore they're really all nice people. That's not what's being said. That's what we think. Because we tend to think if a person, you know, wants to be happy, like if we don't do the equanimity, let's say you have Mr. Trump in the enemy category, let's just say, or whoever you like, I don't care. As soon as you hear the words that he is equal to Mr. Obama, if you love Mr. Obama and hate Mr. Trump, or it could be the other way around. I mean, the Trump followers hate Mr. Obama and love Mr. Trump. So whichever one is yours, you decide what it is. And we all know the logic of this one is. So if we're trying to get equanimity, what we're doing is putting these three people out there. So there's Donna, my friend. Now there's Mr. Obama, my friend, and Mr. Trump, my enemy. And there's maybe, I don't know, Mr., you know, a president from 50 years ago, I don't even know. Whatever one, you know, put Mr. Wilson there, whoever it is, I don't know, can't think of names. He's a stranger. And I don't care about him. Not interested. Bored. Isn't it? A stranger. He's neither done anything that offends me, nor has he done anything that makes me happy. So therefore he's a stranger. Therefore I can't even see him. He's just this vague face, isn't it? A stranger. So you can't look at him. There's the vivid one you love and adore, Mr. Obama. Hates Mr. Trump. Find Mr. Wilson boring, whoever he might be. We get this. We live our lives like this. So automatically, when people say, Mr. Obama wants to be happy, we think, yeah, absolutely, and I want him to be happy because he deserves it. It's contingent for us on his being a good person, which means he's got to agree with me and do what I like. Then he deserves, because what is happiness? This is the point now. Someone wanting to be happy, what love is may he be happy. Love is actually defined as the thought, may he be happy. So the first thing here of equanimity is the recognition that there three of them want to be happy. So then naturally I can then begin to develop love, which is may they be happy. So right now I only want someone to be happy if they make me happy. But now I'm changing it to want them to be happy because they want to be happy. That's what equanimity brings. You put them outside yourself. You separate. But right now, of course I want Mr. Obama to be happy because he makes me happy. And he deserves it. He deserves me. He deserves to be happy. But if and you hear someone say, well, Mr. Trump wants to be happy. Think of this now for a second. We'll go, what are you talking about? So what do you mean he wants to be happy? What the hell are you talking about? He doesn't deserve to be happy. Because we think if you say Mr. Trump wants to be happy, that's getting him off the hook. We think that means he must be nice after all. What have I done wrong? Or the poor fellow, he can't help it, and pat him on the head. We've got a wrong view, but even saying a person wants to be happy. Because they have to deserve it for us. So the first thing we'll say, but he doesn't deserve to be happy. What are you talking about? Look what he's done. This is how we think. So they even hear these simple words that everybody's equal in their wish to be happy, and it's got nothing to do with they're monsters or pedophiles or good or bad people. And that's why it's so shocking. None of that's the issue here. None of that's the point. It's trying to get beyond our own way of seeing the universe, of dividing the world into these three categories. So that's it. There's no fourth category. Think about it. You've only got people you like, you don't like, and you don't care about. There's no fourth category in the universe, among all the animals and the bugs and the creatures and the humans. That's it, because the three poisons are running the show. Friends, enemies, and strangers. And the tragedy is, of course, we can see from working in high school on the mind, we believe in those labels like absolute truth, you know. So this first one of equanimity is really bare bones, getting yourself out of the equation, separating yourself from these three people, seeing them objectively in front of you, and attempting to recognize the truth that in their hearts, each of them, they're driven by the wish to be happy and they're driven by the wish not to suffer. It's a simple, simple, precise fact that we're trying to cultivate. That's the meaning of this equanimity. And it's profound because you're getting yourself out of it. So Mr. Trump still might be a monster, Mr. Obama might be a saint, and Mr. Wilson might be boring. That's not the issue. They're just our personal trips, you know, our projections. So these are, you use different logic here to prove this to be true. It's not some sentimental, gooey feeling. It's a logical, scientific truth. I like the example, use yourself as the three friends, enemy, stranger. So have these three people in front of you right now, whoever you think of in your life at this moment, a person you adore, a person who hates you, and a person who couldn't care about you, bored, like a person who works, who looks at you vaguely, but they don't really see you at all. We've all got people like that. So think of these three people right now. Think of these three people. And you're sitting there, you're standing, you're just you, okay? So now your friend looks at you and you can see their eyes, it looks like they adore you. They're looking all kind of dazzle-eyed and they write a description of you and they know, you know that they're writing about this saint. You're so excited to hear how they see you, think you're adorable, you're so intelligent, you're so beautiful, they love you, how kind you are, and you read it and you get so excited. But you can see that they're seeing a certain person there, and they're seeing a friend. They see a friend. They see you as defined by being a friend. They see friend. You are friend. That's how they define you, your friend. Now, next, get your ex-boyfriend who hates you, who loathes you. They'll write their description of you. You won't even recognize it. So all they're seeing is that they see you're the same person, okay? You're the same person. This friend is over-exaggerating your beauty and your deliciousness. Now the other person, the enemy, is over-exaggerating your ugliness. You can see it. Look, they're looking dagger-eyed at you and this awful description of you. Enemy. Isn't it? The third person, stranger. They can hardly look at you, you're so boring. They can hardly lay their eyes on you because there's nothing in a stranger to grab our attention. Now, the simple point is this. If you've got a headache, while the friend is looking at you, and they call you a friend, you've got a headache, and I ask you the question, do you like having a headache? No. Do you want to be happy? Yes. So the same person, next second, the enemy looks at you, like with daggers. Do you want to be happy, Rabina? Yes. Do you want to be free of a headache? Yes. And the stranger looks at you. I mean, it's so evident they've got made up, the three of them have made up stories. It's so evident they've got their own suggestions on top of you. It's so evident they're not seeing that simple fact that you're you, and each moment they're looking at you, whether one minute you're a friend, next minute you're a monster, next minute you're boring. You want to be happy every second, and you want to not suffer every second. You're no different. You are no different. In you, you are no different. Well, that's exactly the same as a friend, enemy, stranger. So to get past, this is why it's profound and logical, and to get stuff, it's not easy to do this. This is a compassion wing if you haven't done karma and if you haven't done high school and moved your mind deeply. It's not possible to do this. It's too hard. Because we believe in our projections. It's even puzzling to hear, what do you mean he's not horrible? How can you say Mr. Trump is not horrible? We can't even believe he's not horrible. That he's not horrible. It's not possible. Because we think the people who think he's nice are just idiots as well. Because our views are so extreme, you know. But this is the point. Don't chuck the baby out of the bathwater. Saying a person wants to be happy, saying that your anger exaggerates his ugliness, doesn't mean he's still a good person. That's not the issue here. We've got to be so intelligent about it. This demands rigor and clarity and intelligence and discrimination. We're full of emotion, you know. And we believe that my view of the enemy is the enemy. That's the powerful point. So to understand all of that, it's only then that you can hear this view that every sentient being is equal and wishes to be happy. It's a fact that we're trying to prove. And that becomes the basis for you to want to grow the wish they be happy, which is love, and the wish they not suffer, which is compassion. And so now before your wish that they be happy or not suffering is only for that first group and it's contingent on attachment. And they're doing what you want. They're the only group. But now you've got yourself out of the equation. And also, because you've also realized that your mother can't decide and all this stuff, you've got much more objectivity. And one is a saint, one is a pedophile, and one is a boring person. They might be facts, but you don't any longer interpret in relation to you. You get your own projections out of the way. This is profound. And this is the first of the 11 techniques before you get anywhere near bodhicitta, anywhere near love and compassion. This is the fundamental starting point. Very necessary to get to them. This is a huge one already. Now some of the questions. Quarter past, whatever it is.
Yes, Venerable, there's several questions in chat.
Good, okay.
Okay, one question is, how does a tendency arise from a beginningless cause? How does it start to build? Is it from redirected awareness and concentration? Basically, the question is, where does any seed of action or thought, good or bad, first arise if it's never been part of that life form's existence before?
Well, the key question is, where does it begin? And that's a non-question. It's a misconception for the Buddha. It's a wrong question. And this is why I've got to really think about this, you know. In the case of positing a creator, in the case of positing materialist views that you come from mummy, daddy, and grandma and the monkeys, in both cases, you can say we're looking for the beginning. So we all know with the Western view, we're looking for the first big bang, you know. We're looking for the big thing. And it's very fascinating. In our minds, we're desperate to find the first moment. Even in this life, when we build up all our habits over the years and you go to your therapist, we all know with the philosophical views we have about who I am and where I come from and why I'm suffering and why things happen. We look into the past, kind of trying to find a needle in the haystack, isn't it? We're convinced that we'll find back then, that's when it began. That's when the mother did that to her. That's why she's now got fear. That's why she gets depressed. That's why she does this. We're convinced in our mind, without analysis, that there has to be a first moment. Well, Buddha says this is a misconception coming from the belief of no cause and effect, coming from grasping at things as permanent, which in turn comes from grasping at things as intrinsic. It's a fundamental philosophical and experiential misconception. There can't be a first moment. And that's because if cause and effect is the law that runs the universe, and the cause and effect Buddha's talking about is very precise, that this moment of anger, for example, its main cause, its substantial cause, is a previous moment of anger. It has to be. And that previous moment of anger. What caused that? A previous moment of anger. And you're going to go back 42 trillion years looking, convinced that we'll sort of get back to the first one. You can never get back to a first one. Not because you can't see it, but because it can't exist. And that's nutty for us. To think that our consciousness is beginningless is the nuttiest thing we have ever heard. So we've got to get used to this concept and just think it through logically. But just as a theory, you can't have a first cause. If you have a first cause, that implies that that didn't have a cause. And if you posit cause and effect, you can't have a thing called a first cause. So minds are beginningless. Anger is beginningless. Intelligence is beginningless. Love is beginningless. But, as Buddha has found out, all the delusions are absolutely able to be ended. So you know very well the chicken and egg. If you have an egg, you know it came from a chicken. But if you've got an egg, you can break it anytime you like and never get another chicken. And that Buddha's view, he has found that logically, experientially, that deluded states of mind, because they're the voices of ego, because they're misconceptions, they can be ended. That's his whole entire point. But they cannot have a beginning. I mean, we're all in Dalai Lama's conversations with all the, you know, all the scientists and things, and I mean, it's like colloquial. Talking about, he said, Big Bang? No problem. Just not the first Big Bang, that's all. The fact that we want a first moment, Buddha says, that indicates the depth of our grasping at things as being not caused, which is grasping at things as permanent, and indeed even underneath that, grasping at things as having an intrinsic nature. They are misconceptions, Buddha says, and our question comes from those misconceptions. So it is a bit of thinking and nutting out, you know. Another one, Buddha? Another? Donna?
Yes. This question is, within samsara, when I am born into another body, does that happen into a body that I conceive as being in the future, or can I also be reborn into the past, is cause and effect necessarily linear or chronological?
I think if we look at the world as we understand it, forget reincarnation. I think we accept the the simple experiential scientific truth of past, present, and future. We know that we began as a baby. We know inexorably we will end up as an old person. We've never met a person who's suddenly becomes a baby again. I don't think it's ever happened. I don't think anybody's ever discovered a seed that turns into a rose that then reverses and directs into a seed. I don't think it's not feasible. It's not possible. So why make it a fantasy? And we're talking the simple logic here. We're talking some abstract thing beyond logic. I think past by definition is what happened before the present, and present by definition is what happens before the future. It's just the concepts we use, the words we use, and these have come out of our experience. They're not kind of plonked onto reality. This is the conventional world we live in. That's the answer.
And then another question is, instead of viewing strangers in terms of they can all drop dead, can't strangers be seen on the flip side as hoping they are happy and free from suffering?
Well, that's the point. That's the whole point we're getting to. That's what we're trying to aim for. That's the point. Yeah, exactly, but the enemy as well. And I just began with what is equanimity. First, we established what a friend, enemy, stranger is. So we want the friend to be happy. We want the enemy to suffer, and we couldn't care less about the stranger. So obviously, as we progress through these 11 stages, we're going to get to incredible love, compassion, great compassion. We want all of them to be happy and all of them to not suffer. Of course, that's the point. We've got to get equanimity first as a basis. Absolutely, yes. Yeah. Of course. That's the point. I always tell a story that is very funny. I mean, it's how we are. I read my iPad, and I looked at my New York Times, and you know, I saw out in the corner of my eye, down the corner on the homepage, a heading that said, 350 people die in ferry accident in Tasmania. And that's Australia, so that's my people, right? Even though I'm an American, I still feel like Australian as well. I can't help it. When I went to my American passport, I said, can I keep my other passports? And she said, we don't care how many passports you have, as long as you have allegiance to America. So I've got to feel like an American. I don't think I know how to do that yet. Never mind. But anyway, I saw this heading, Tasmania is Australia. I went, oh, no. And then I saw it said Tanzania. And I went, oh, that's okay. No, no, because I caught myself and had compassion, you know, but that's just natural. It's strange. I think, where's Tanzania, you know? So it was different from me. That's how we all are. Go on, what's the next question?
The next one is, are there ways to train the mind about letting go of resentment?
What problem is that? Say it again, Donna.
Are there ways to train the mind about letting go of resentment?
I mean, yes, look at resentment. Look at it. It's a heavy level of anger, isn't it? Someone's hurt us. And, I mean, look at people, look at our lives, you know. Everybody, right now, has had people harm them. And we can see even the harm that those people have done to us has not been to do with anything we have done in this life. That's a fact, and that's where we, I think, is the source of where we go mad. I mean, if you had a, you know, if I had a bitter fight with Donna, she shouted at me and I shouted, she punched and I punched, if I'm brave enough, I'll accept that somehow I harmed her as well. But if, especially if we've really been harmed by people who haven't harmed, whom we haven't harmed, and that is a very common thing on this planet. This is the depth and pain of our suffering, you know. So naturally, if we have anger is, it's just, it's kind of like, anger is like this, why did this happen? I mean, I find this absolutely beyond extraordinarily brilliant, but so telling. Our first level of pain is, why did that happen? It's fascinating to me that we ask the question. So why did that happen? What's it based on? Because we say, I don't deserve it. So that's what it's based on. That means we remember we did nothing to do anything to that person, and suddenly they lash out, or they lie to us, or they steal from us, or they cheat on us. We know we did nothing. So this is where we have this powerful feeling of deserve and not deserve. It's very fascinating. So when we realize attachment is this kind of, now what do you mean? And this is what's beneath anger and resentment. I'm getting to resentment. It's beneath the anger, and it's the entitlement and assumption that somehow only good things should happen. So we think we deserve good things, which is a very weird assumption. What we really mean is we want good things. And then when the bad thing happens, we think, why did that happen? I don't deserve it. But I think what we really mean is, I don't like it. That's more sincere. That's more truthful. But it's fascinating to question and analyze, where does this deserve come from? Think about it, please. It's very fascinating. Think about this now. Resentment is a heavier level of anger. So I'm just doing an analysis. And the point of this analysis isn't just to be clever intellectually. The analysis is part of what we should do, which is how we counteract the pain, by having an analysis. Because this is what's underneath. You're feeling the pain of resentment, which is the pain of anger and being hurt and harmed, and you were, I'm quite sure, but it's the feeling of it that you're mostly talking about. We've got to unpack the assumptions beneath this pain. This is a slow, gradual step. So everyone, I'm saying, it is part of the practice to use this as our analysis. If we choose to use, you know, so we're going to get to the view of karma in a minute. The different things. So, I use a simple example. If you have money in your bank, your bank account, you would never look in the bank and say, how dare there be no dollars in my bank? I deserve dollars. I don't think anybody would say that. So look at the assumption there. Why wouldn't you say that? Because this is the point. You know, it's your bank account. Because it's your bank account. Because you put the money in, or you didn't. One or the other. You own the fact. So you'd never say, I deserve dollars. Because that means you assume someone else is responsible for making you happy. And that is our pain. That's the pain of attachment. It's an assumption that somehow I didn't ask to get bored. That's somebody's job to make me happy. So, because I deserve it. This is the hubris and the entitlement of attachment that we're born with from countless lives. So it's completely got no basis in reality, Buddha says. So what's anger? How dare they do that to me? I don't deserve it. The feeling of pain and resentment is unbearable because we can't find any logical reason why they did it. And that means I didn't do anything to deserve it. So that's the same as saying, who put weeds in my garden? I don't deserve them. You would never say that. because you know it's your garden and they're your weeds. That's the view of karma. That's why my Tibetan friend Jigdro, when I said to him, after he's been tortured, he's escaped, his daddy murdered, brother murdered, friend tortured, and I said to him, do you get angry? And he laughed and said, angry, Rabina, what for? Or why those young women were not angry. This is hard for us to hear. This is a big picture answer. And this does not happen overnight, I promise you. So what Buddha's saying is resentment and anger and attachment, and which are real pain, own them, don't feel guilty or jealousy or the rest. They're all misconceptions rooted in wrong assumptions. This is really hard to hear. And that's why those young Tibetan women were not angry. That's why my Jigro friend was not angry, because the analysis in their mind was the analysis of karma. Our analysis is innocent victims who do not have to get born. And the sense of entitlement, we should only have the good things, and how dare bad things happen. Don't criticize ourselves, but that's the analysis of anger and attachment and resentment and all the rest. It's the analysis of it. But it's really hard to hear this. It's really hard to own it. We should weep and cry and have sorry for ourselves, absolutely. But if we're trying to be Buddhist, that's the analysis we have to learn. But if we've never studied karma, and if we've never studied the mind's delusions, how can we do the analysis? We can't. I mean, this is a big picture answer, okay? Pretty intense one. And of course, it's up to you. I don't know if you have the view of karma or not. That's the big picture view. And then eventually, if you really get this one on board, you would be like those young women. But that takes time to practice it. It takes time to practice. So meanwhile, take care of ourselves, have a good therapist, weep, take care of ourselves, and slowly heal the pain, you know? But it is absolutely not easy. Of course it's not. What else, Tony?
Katie had the question, what is this thought process applicable to self? What if you feel you don't deserve good things?
Well, that's the self-loathing we have. It's kind of bizarre. It's kind of the irony of ego. That we... This is so fascinating, actually. The analysis of this one is so fascinating. You see, attachment, its main energy from lots and lots of lives of practicing, and this is the energetic level of it, and as Amazobi says, it's the main suffering in our plan, in our work, Western world, is actually the feeling of terrible dissatisfaction, which is, I am not enough. I am not good enough. That's exactly what we think. That's what we call self-loathing. It's actually the symptom of a bottomless pit of practicing attachment. The feeling is I have not got enough, and I am not enough, and I don't, no matter what you say, it's not enough. You tell me you love me, I don't believe you. I don't believe you. So that is actually self-loathing. That's what we call self-loathing. It's dissatisfaction, and it's a symptom of attachment. It's so kind of bizarre to hear it this way, but that's a common... I mean, Dalai Lama heard it, and he said he was shocked by the way we have that in our culture. It just shows us the depth of the habit of attachment that comes into this world, and we're just always dissatisfied, always seeing never enough. No matter what we get, never enough. No matter how much Dalai tells me she's my friend, it's never enough. How much money, never enough. How much food, never enough. We mainly feel it in relation to the person, ourselves, you know. I'm not enough. That is what we call self-loathing. So of course you don't deserve good things. Of course you don't. It's so bizarre, isn't it? I mean, the fact that we can endlessly speak about our bad qualities, but someone asks you your good qualities, we kind of blush and get embarrassed, and we can't think of any. But we're hungry for someone else to tell us we've got good qualities, but we don't believe them when they do. Which shows, it proves it's so bizarre, and this is what ego is. It's so ironic. 47 people can praise you. You do not believe one word of it. One person criticizes. You run like a magnet and believe it 100%. That's how we are. It's just, this is so bizarre to us, but this is the way ego works. It's self-loathing, and that's the function of attachment. Never satisfied. Never happy. Never enough. It's the nightmare of our suffering. So we have to learn to know we are enough and are good. And that's really what probably almost, you know, have to heal this sense of I'm nothing. It's like this schizophrenic sense of being disconnected. And that's why when we look at the depth of the suffering of attachment in a more overt way, the deepest attachment is attachment to being seen as a good person, We're hungry for that, even though we can't believe it. We're hungry for other person to say we're a nice person. And it's almost like we're so distressed that on our own, it's like we're nothing. We are only becoming a real person when someone says you're a nice person. That's why we get lonely. This attachment is called attachment to being, I mean, they call it attachment to reputation, but actually it's attachment, this assumption I'm nothing unless someone says I'm something. That's how desperate we are, all of us, you know? That's why we get so lonely. That's why we all want, I mean, in other words, we're attached to being liked. But when we have so much self-loathing, we push the people away and don't believe them. This is how demented we are. This is really how twisted we are. This is the suffering of attachment and aversion and ignorance, the three root delusions. So we have a lot of work to do, you know. Because Buddha says we are everything already. Everything that we are is there, and we can develop it to perfection. It's an incredible view, you know. That's why it's so nice to read some of the yogi stories and read about the nature of mind, how we are naturally clear, naturally blissful. It's not hard to hear it. It's very powerful, you know.
That was powerful, and thank you very much for answering. That makes complete sense when you explain it. Thank you.
Good, Katie. Good, darling. Thank you. What else, darling?
There are no further questions in chat, so I don't know if anyone else
wants to talk to me then. Come on, someone talk to me. Who wants to talk to me? Anyway, oh, yes, good, Francis. Speak to me, sweetheart.
Good morning, everyone. My question.
Good morning. Where are you?
Byron Bay.
Oh, you're in Australia. Oh, good. Well done, darling. What is it there? 10:30. Very civilized. Byron Bay is good, by the way. Are you still on lockdown in Byron Bay?
I'm coming. I'm going back to work next week.
Well done.
After being in lockdown for 9 weeks.
Oh, my God. You're looking forward to it?
No, I'm loving lockdown. Because of all the teachings.
There you go. I know. It's fascinating, isn't it, Francis? I know. It's amazing, isn't it?
I don't want to go back to work. Anyway, my question is, if we take the riots in America as an example, and we are not going to get angry about it, we're going to be shocked but not angry, and you said the next thing we can say is, so what can I do to help?
Yes, exactly.
And that's my question. So yes. What can I do to help? I can pray, because I'm an old Catholic, so I can pray all the time.
Yes, exactly.
But what can I do to help?
Okay, Francis, this is the essence of the bodhisattva approach. This is the essence of the compassion one. And this is a tough answer. But let's look at it. Okay. When we think, what can I do to help? You see, the attachment in us, because the attachment in us only wants it to be lovely. So that's where either we're a type of person who, when they see the bad things happen, get depressed. You understand? Or another person, that's more my style, when you see the bad thing happen, you get angry. So depression is internalized anger, and anger is externalized aversion. You understand? So they're the two responses. Because our attachment is very distressed, and we get angry, and we wish it would all go away. So then we think, okay, I'm going to have compassion here, and I'm going to say, like Martin Luther King, what can I do to help? But the point is this. If Francis, if you can hop on an aeroplane, and I'll pay for you if you can, come to America and fix it. Honey child, don't hesitate. Now, we know we can't do that, especially something this big. You can even know with your next door neighbor, one person suffering. You can think, what can I do to help? And then you check the neighbor, you hear their crazy mind, you hear their violent actions, you see how they're demented, you see how they can't listen to you. You realize that even one person you cannot help. So this is the part where the bodhisattvas get enormous courage. Because the more they've given up their attachment, the more courageous they become, that when they see the suffering, it doesn't freak them out. But what it does instead is encourage them, because they see such suffering, they see everybody harming themselves and each other, and that it doesn't make them shrink, it doesn't make them want to make it all go away, which is attachment, that gives them extra courage to never give up becoming a Buddha.
Okay.
That's the point. So you just, it gives you, every time you see more suffering, you think, God, I can't give up. Like as if the bodhisattvas are like this, everyone is their precious child. You know you can't fix them now, but you're never going to give up, and you do everything you can. So that means not just for the people in America, the crazies, or having their, you know, riots, or whoever they are, on this side of the world, but, you know, when you see the ant, you try to help the ant. When you see the dog, you try to help the dog. You don't just think grand things of rushing off to America or being like Mother Teresa. You continue. Bodhicitta has two things. One is I must never stop helping whoever's in front of me. So if it's an ant, you help them. If it's a dog, you help them. If it's a crazy, you help them. And then the long-term goal is I must never give up on continuing to work step by step so I'll become a Buddha. And so that's the point. The more we have that courage, the more that gives us the courage to never give up. But recognizing it's a nightmare and not, see, it's attachment that makes it want to all go away. And we can't bear it. But the less attachment, the less anger, the more courage, the more enthusiasm to keep helping. That's the point.
Wonderful.
Oh, darling. That's good.
Thank you.
Thank you, darling. Such a perfect...
I'm just going to write that down.
Yes, absolutely. Write it down. As Lama Zabu would say, write it down. It's true. Come on. That's the bodhisattva attitude. You have this courage, you know. And that's the one. And that takes time. Just have to say, I've got to keep going. And as Dalai Lama says, bodhisattvas think in terms of eons. Attachment wants us to make it all go away because we can't bear it. So as we lessen attachment, we lessen anger, we get more courageous and we mean this, I will never give up. I'll just keep going. Keep optimistic. Bodhisattvas are hugely optimistic because the point is, even though the world is a nightmare, optimism is your only option. If you start panicking while you're all drowning, you'll all drown together. So if you keep your wits about you, you'll just keep going and do what you can. Do you understand? That's the point, darling. Thank you so much. What else, people?
Sandy has her hand up to ask a question.
Good, Sandy, sweetheart. Talk to me.
Hi, Venerable. It's Sandile from South Africa.
Hello, darling. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. It's good.
Are you in South Africa now?
Yes, I am. It's 3 a.m. in the morning. We're all good. We're all fine.
What time is it? Well done. You're very courageous.
Thank you. I'm doing very well. I'm doing very, very well. I've really enjoyed the lockdown because it's helped me to just do my practices and to do my readings
there you
and
go.
Just catch up with my own self.
There you go, darling. Wonderful. Well done.
Yeah. My question has to do with, you know, there's so much violence going on out there in the world right now. Yeah. And I think there's such a hype that is kind of like increasing it by the day.
Yeah.
And I just want to ask, how do we continue to draw more towards bodhicitta for ourselves as opposed to being consumed by this ocean of hate, of violence, of wrong views, and very mistaken errors around how we treat each other's humanity?
Well, I mean, that's what we're talking about here, Sandra. One step at a time, in the very first level, I mean, you know, taking the view of karma is already a huge one. And we all realize we've all had countless lives. I've been the enemy one life, you've been the friend the next life. I've been black one life, you've been white the next life. I've been male one life, you're the girl next life. When we really have that view, and it's pretty intellectual for us, unless we're clairvoyant, but it kind of makes it very spacious. It's like you're seeing you've got two children, and one day Johnny comes and cries because Mary beat up Johnny, and next day Mary comes because Johnny beat up Mary, and you do have love and compassion for both of them. So you've got to have that broader, bigger view. I mean, the view of karma makes sense to you, or not?
It does, for sure.
Okay,
for sure.
This is a fundamental starting point. This is giving you much more perspective. Mm. And then when you realize karma, you realize ignorance, how it forces us out of habit to do dumb things to harm each other, which harms us.
Mm.
So this is the basis. Once you've got that clear and you understand karma and understand delusions, you just observe these maniacs who are all harming each other and blaming everybody else and going completely crazy or not having a proper analysis and not knowing how to be persevering like Martin Luther King to navigate it without losing the plot. But you've got, and then eventually, that's what brings compassion for yourself because you realize you're in that boat. Then you have compassion for others. And then, as I said to Francis, you just got to keep going because suddenly what choice do you have? If you have the view of karma and you have the view of countless lifetimes, there is no other option. There is no other option but to take care of yourself, to develop your own qualities, to become more steady, more clear, and more compassionate, and more wise. There is no other option. There is no other. That's it.
And practicing Tonglen, of course, right? But they're taking giving.
All the practices, all in their proper order. It's all there laid out in a big map, you know. So
do
them according to our own capacity. So you know, if you have all the toolkits, if you have the whole path, you can practice any one of those tools in a given day. At one point, your first level of practice is control your speech and your body. So if you're really going to get angry, you control your speech. Another time, you control your mind. Another time, you say a kind word. Another time, you say a mantra. You have all these different tools that you're using according to your needs, according to the situation. You just have to keep going. That is the attitude of the bodhisattvas. They just have this attitude of never giving up. And that's the point. When we have that, that's what gives us enthusiasm. That's what enthusiasm is. When you just don't give up. And then we know just that enthusiasm gives everybody else courage. Look at the Dalai Lama. Observe the Dalai Lama for 60 years. He's been on this planet. We've seen him around the West, you know, in the West, or in the world now. I mean, that's what people love about him. They don't might know why he's so perky and happy, but they just love this enthusiasm and this never giving up, and he's also very easygoing. That's why people absolutely adore the man, you know? And that's why people adore Bishop Tutu.
Yeah, he's here with us, yeah.
People just need examples like that. Do you know, about even your own friends, if you can just remain there, don't give lectures all the time and don't rave on about things, but be understanding, be kind, be wise. People want people like that in their lives. We need people to help us hold our crazy emotions. So that's how you can help people, just by being a kind person. I tell you.
Yeah. Thanks, Honorable. I really appreciate that.
You understand?
Yeah, thank you so much. No, I really do. And I think each of us have the responsibility to make a difference within ourselves first.
That's it. And if you can't, how can you help others? Impossible.
Correct.
That's wonderful.
Thanks very much. Good night. I'm going to go to bed now.
Thank you so much.
Okay, take care. Bye.
Hello, Venerable. Zenugraha from Brazil. I have a different name tonight. I have a question. I wasn't bored about reflecting on past and future lives because I was born feeling it natural.
Yes.
But now, with all the situation we are living, and sometimes I try to talk to my children and my friends, which are not Buddhists, you know. Mm-hmm. And when I tell them this is just the result of cause and conditions we created and so on, I have no argument to tell them, you know. My son said to me, I've been a good boy since I was born. How can you blame me about what's going on the whole planet now?
Of course.
So please help me.
Well, darling,
we'll see on Saturday to watch
you. You see, sweetheart, you cannot, there is no answer. That's why, you see, on this planet, we've got lots of different philosophical presentations of the world. Think of it that way. You've got the Catholics. You've got the Muslims. You've got the Australian Aboriginals. You've got so many different groups of people, all who have different philosophical views, different philosophical presentations of the world. Now, it seems to me, here we're using the Buddhist one. The Buddhist one, as I've just said, by those Tibetans, they just naturally assume countless past and future lives. So that informs everything they see. Immediately, even like those young women, totally innocent, these little young women, those two young nuns, wouldn't even hurt a fly, but there they were sexually abused and tortured. But because of the big view they had in their mind, that informed their ability to handle it. Now, if you're a Christian and you're devoted to God, I mean, I've heard many stories. People who are completely, I mean, I'm two Muslims. Years ago in Malaysia, one of the aeroplanes went down and they were all Muslims. And this Muslim mummy and daddy were asked how they felt about the death of their daughter. I've lost, oh, there you are. And they said, she belongs to God. God has taken her back. We are content. Now think about what I'm saying. That is a philosophical view, isn't it? It's a viewpoint in their mind, isn't it? So look what the result was. It made them happy. They were content. So everything comes down to the view you have. So the Buddha's view asserts past lives and karma, so that view, if you really live it, would not make you crazy, and you will have contentment, and you'll know why it happened, and you'll have compassion. Now, the Christian view, the Muslim view, if you really practice it, can make you an incredible person. But with respect, the materialist view really doesn't have an answer. There is no explanation for why things happen. So no wonder we all go crazy. So if you've got a person who's just a fairly good human being who doesn't ask the questions why do things happen and they somehow learn to accept it, that's an unusual person. But why do you think we go crazy? Because we all have the view that I'm an innocent victim, I didn't ask to get bored, and it's not my fault. That's what ego feels. So we're all going to go crazy and suffer. And there is no answer. Very simply, science has no answer for why innocent victims get hurt. So you have to learn to deal with it. That's why there's so much suffering on the planet, because we don't have an answer. That's all I can say, you know. So it's up to each one of us. You can't force karma down someone's throat. You can't force a person to be a Christian. You know, each person is very different. They come into this life with different qualities. But we just have to, I mean, it's our responsibility to come up with these things, to try and work out why these things happen. And that's what scientists do. That's what Christians do. That's what Buddhists do. It's up to each one of us, you know. And if we don't have an answer, we have to find a way to live with it. What choice do you have? You see what I'm trying to say? Good. So it's up to your son. Your son has to find out what he thinks. Your son has to work out things. He has to work out how to live his life. He has to work out, if he hasn't got an answer, he has to work out how he's going to navigate all this and accept bad things will happen and he doesn't know why. That's up to him. Just give the man love, give him a big hug, and hope he finds his own way.
I ask him to watch you on Saturday.
Oh, really?
Okay. I'm going to be talking to Brazil.
That's right. I am. I'm sorry. That's right.
Yes. Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Bye.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, darling. Okay, people, what else?
George has a question.
Go, George. Talk to me.
Venerable Rabina, thank you so much for your teaching, first of all.
Okay. Total pleasure.
I'm new to Buddhism, and so I have a lot of questions.
But I can't see you, George. Where's your face?
You, I'm here. I'm here.
But I can see, or I can just see my face. Where are you?
I'm waving.
I know, but I should be seeing you if I put the thing on. You should come, but I come instead. Never mind. I'm seeing you. Go back. I'm fine.
Okay. When we escape samsara and reach nirvana, what is that? What happens?
I'll tell you exactly. I'll tell you exactly, George. Okay. Buddha's saying we're in samsara, quote unquote, if we have this ego grasping that clings to a certain sense of concrete me, that then gives rise to this intense attachment that I must get what I want every second, which then gives rise to anger when I don't get what I want, and then all the other millions of different neuroses, depression and pride and arrogance and fear. And that's, the Buddha says that's the samsaric philosophy. And that, if you think about it, is how we naturally feel. And he says it's because we've been programmed with that, and we come into this life, and we just assume it's true. No one has to even teach us this. It's just natural. He says that's, you know, what he means by being in samsara isn't some place. It's having those conceptual views deep in our bones that we assume are the truth. And because he says they are misconceptions, this is why we're always bumping into reality, and that's why we suffer. Why do you do that to me? How dare that happen? I don't deserve it. I expect to be good. That's what attachment and aversion cause. And he says that is what being in samsara means. So giving up attachment, giving up anger, and it takes time, then hold your breath, giving up ego grasping by realizing emptiness, and then when you cut the root of all that stuff, and that can take a while, that's, and then you eventually perfect all that, at some point you will have cut all the rubbish, and that's what they mean by now you're in nirvana. It's not some place like heaven. It's your mind in this very body once you completely change your conceptual constructs that he said they're all fantasy, and you're now in sync with reality, and you have infinite compassion and wisdom. That is what being in nirvana means, and it's your mind, and you do the inner work to make it happen.
And when I will still be born back into this world.
No, once you get to that, you don't need to be reborn. But if you're on the bodhisattva path, you want to be reborn. But you've finished the job. Okay. You don't need to be. You've cut the root. You've cut the motor. When you've achieved your nirvana, you don't need to come back, baby. And you'll just stay to a subtle state of bliss. But if you want
which
to also...
is why the Dalai Lama comes back again.
Exactly. He's done the job, babe. He doesn't need a boring old bag of bones, but he chooses to because he has compassion. That's the plan.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, George.
Sure.
May you achieve it.
Thank you.
Good.
There's a question from a student watching in YouTube.
Okay.
Her question is, the world seems to really have gone mad this year. Has samsara always been this terrible?
You know, I've got a feeling it is. You know, I mean, we can look at history. If you read history, even just within the few thousand years that we know about, even a couple of thousand years, I mean, I think suffering is just, don't you think it's there? Look at some of the wars, look at some of the monstrous things, look at all the witch hunts, look at all the fires and burnt, look at the superstitious minds of humans over the centuries, you know? So in that sense, no, samsara has not changed, it's the same. It just comes in different shapes and sizes, you know? So this is why people often say, when the historians always say, you've got to learn from history. But the Buddhists, you never learn from history. You've got to learn from your own mind. You've got to learn from your own experiences. So history is like very personal. So when you learn from your own mistakes, then you'll change your mind. then there won't be suffering. Then you get rid of samsara. So we can't live for anybody else's mistakes. We've got to change our minds. Samsara is always like this. I mean, Buddha would say many other realms of existence are a lot worse than the human one. You know? So it's like, yeah, you've got to... So that's why I know just recently, I think I mentioned it, I used to say about political activity in the past. I know when I was involved in all the, you know, back in 50 years ago, when I was with this group supporting all the, you know, all the racism going on then, the Black Panthers and all this stuff, and all this kind of noble activity of helping everybody in the world and changing, and then you thought, oh, everything's changing, it's so amazing. And I look back 50 years ago, and it's like worse in many ways now, you know. Some things have changed, some things are good, but it's just the same. Because, and why? This is the point. Why is it the same? Because the Buddhist analysis is because of ego grasping, attachment and anger. I know it sounds so cute. It sounds almost too simplistic, but it's this fundamental understanding of the mind. And if that keeps staying the same, nothing will ever change. So we have to change our minds. Keep doing good activity, but change our minds. Peace will never come if we don't change our minds. So change our mind and keep demonstrating and trying to do our best, you know. So yeah, it's always been like it, I think. Because delusions have always been there. That's it. That's the Buddhist one. Delusions are always there. If it's delusions, you'll keep having these sufferings, you know. Any time to go home?
There's one final question if you want to take it, or we can...
Yes, of course.
What mind states or behaviors characterize the state of renunciation beyond the simple description of reaching a state of being sick of suffering? Are there degrees of
renunciation? Absolutely, yeah. It's very simple, very clear, very clear, very clear, very simple. When you've got some sense of renunciation, that means you've recognized that attachment and aversion are the cause of your pain. They are why you do dumb things with your body and speech that harm you, that harm others. So when you understand that, you've woken up and you now practice. You begin to get discipline, you live in vows, you don't harm others, you work on your mind, you become your own therapist. That means you've lessened your negative behavior, you've lessened attachment, it means your mind is not up and down like a yo-yo, you've lessened your anger, you've lessened your depression, you've lessened your jealousy, you've lessened your neuroses. What does that mean? How would you be? You'd be this blissful, content, happy, wise, wonderful, fun person. That's how you'd be if you had renunciation. The words sound very forbidding. That's the kind of person you'd be, because you've harnessed your own crazy energy, you're in control of who you are, you have enormous self-respect, you're extremely content, and you're joyful, and you're compassionate, and you're able to help others, and you're courageous. You'd be a marvelous human being. That's the answer. Who wouldn't want to be like that? And we should end on that point. 5 minutes to go. Now that we're finished with a wee meditation, okay? Well, the Lama Yeshe's Mahamudra book is so wonderful. And it is a marvelous technique. It's quite sophisticated, but it seems on the face quite simple. It's a method for realizing emptiness. But the starting point of the meditation is to concentrate on the clarity of our mind. So there's these wonderful teachings about the mind in the Buddhist psychology, how consciousness itself, our very function of cognition is pure and clear. Right now it's all muddied and polluted by all our dramas, up and down, yo-yo, you know, rubbish and nonsense. But its true nature is clear. So the first part of the meditation is it's concentration meditation. The difference is you're not focusing on the breath. You're simply focusing on whatever pops up in your mind. So we'll do that for a few minutes just to finish, okay? So just be very relaxed, treat like a very normal action. Just sit comfortably for a few, we're going to do about 3 minutes, okay? Just be comfy, be very relaxed, very natural, be very comfortable. And your back straight, your body upright, not tense, your head slightly forward, chin tucked in, your lips slightly apart. This is the classic position that all the great yogis have found to be most conducive for good meditation. Your head tilted forward, chin tucked in, and the tip of the tongue, just for a couple of minutes, okay, be behind the top teeth. It stops you from dribbling, unless for the long-term meditators. We're just going to do 3 minutes. So your eyes should be looking down, as underneath your eyelids, as if you're looking along your nose towards the ground, okay? So your body comfy, head slightly forward, chin tucked in, have your hands in your lap, just relaxed. Lips slightly apart, jaw relaxed, tip of the tongue behind the top teeth, stops from jiggling, like I said, and the eyes looking down, and just settle into this position now, very unself-consciously. So now with determination, for 3 quality minutes, with determination, we think, I'm going to pay attention to whatever pops up in my mind. And the point is, it's like you're going to watch television with no commentary. The thoughts are going to come and go. You don't engage in them. You don't analyze them. You don't wish they'd go away. You don't think what they mean. You just let them come and you let them go. That's it, okay? Just pay attention to your thoughts. Just keep your mind focused on your thoughts. So relax now. That was about 3 minutes. And that's good quality 3 minutes. We made an effort for 3 minutes to pay attention to every second. That's pretty powerful. So we just think, okay, we've been nearly 2 hours, all these thoughts we've had. Nothing gone astray. Everything gets stored in the mind, all our thoughts and memories, everything gets stored. Wasn't we've been sowing seeds, you know? Making these aspirations we made at the beginning, we're going to listen so we can develop our marvelous potential, so we can help others. So we think maybe all these seeds we planted, we keep to nourish them with our practice, whatever that practice is, with enthusiasm, never giving up. There's no choice. And there's no giving up. Just keep moving one step at a time. Working on our mind and trying to help others one step at a time. Pace ourselves, you know. Take care of ourselves. Feel the pain and the resentment, the hurt, the grief we're feeling. Take care of ourselves and nurture ourselves. Have good friends to support us, but just never give up on our own amazing potential, okay? Jansu, Tentogravote, Makie Panam, Ke Yuchi, Ke Panya Pam, Me Payan, Gong Ne Gongu, Pervasho. I jumped in too quickly, Donna. Sorry. It's okay. Enough. Thank you, darling people. See some of you tomorrow.